Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. So we speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, we have reports from Jill Robbins and Pete Musto. Later, Alice Bryant brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with the American story, The Blue Hotel, by Stephen Crane. The literary and human rights organization, PEN America, is honoring three women's rights activists jailed in Saudi Arabia. The group announced recently that they have won the PEN Barbie Freedom to Write Award. The three are Nouf Abdelaziz, Loujain Alhathloul, and Iman Alnafjan. The Associated Press notes that their arrests last year have been condemned around the world. Saudi Arabia says the activists were detained for working to undermine the security of the country. The detainees have openly opposed government policies that they believe restrict women's rights. The PEN Award comes at a time of intense international criticism of Saudi Arabia and its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. In October 2018, Saudi activist and journalist Jamal Khashoggi went missing during a visit to the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Investigators blame Saudi agents for his disappearance. They say Khashoggi was murdered. Earlier this month, the United Nations Human Rights Council denounced Saudi Arabia's continuing arrests and arbitrary detentions of human rights defenders. PEN has long noted that the Freedom to Write Award has been a way of turning advocacy into action. The group says 37 of the past 43 winners have been freed, at least in part because of the attention raised by the prize. "It helped me to survive while I was in prison," said Ahmed Naji, who won the award in 2016. He had been imprisoned in Egypt. The writer and journalist now lives in Washington, D.C. PEN officials have not decided who will accept the Freedom to Write Award on behalf of the three Saudi women's rights activists. The PEN Awards ceremony will take place in New York City on May 21st.
Do you like to drink Coca-Cola? You can thank enslaved Africans. They brought the cola nut, one of the main parts of Coca-Cola, to what is now the United States. West Africans chewed the nut for its caffeine. Enslaved Africans also brought watermelon, okra, yams, black-eyed peas, and some peppers. These foods are commonly eaten in the U.S. today. They show how Africans forced into slavery, beginning in the 1500s, influenced the American diet. Frederick Opie wrote a book about some of the foods that connect Africa and America. The book is called Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. Opie also teaches history at Babson College in Massachusetts. He says, "If you know what people eat, you can find out where they're from. Opie explains that people who were bringing enslaved Africans to North America wanted to keep them alive and earn a profit. As a result, Africans on the slave ships were fed food they knew and liked. Those foods landed along with the people. Opie explains that fruits and vegetables brought from Africa grew well in America. One reason is because enslaved Africans planted their own gardens to help feed themselves. In time, the plants from Africa slowly moved from gardens of the enslaved to those of the wealthy and powerful. For example, the homes of U.S. Presidents George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had gardens planted with seeds from Africa. Those fruits and vegetables changed the way cooks made pies in America. In England, pies were made with meat. African Americans took the English meat pie and made it with fruit or vegetables, such as sweet potatoes. Kelly Dietz is with Stratford Hall in the U.S. state of Virginia, and the writer of a book about the influence of Virginia's enslaved cooks. It is called Bound to the Fire. Virginia's enslaved cooks included Hercules, a man who worked in the home of George Washington. Washington's family loved Hercules's cooking. Washington's step-grandson described Hercules as one of the best chefs in America. Washington praised Hercules's cooking so much, the president was reportedly angered and surprised when Hercules escaped and sought his own freedom. Yet, for the most part, writer Kelly Dietz says, the skilled black chef has been written out of American history. In fact, both their work and their skill shaped American food. For example, enslaved cooks developed gumbo, jambalaya, pepper pot, and a mix of green leafy vegetables and pork called Hoppin' John, says Dietz. And, she adds, some ways of cooking that are well known in the U.S. today were reported in West Africa before 1500. They include deep frying fish and barbecuing meats. Dietz says these kinds of foods were critical to the creation of Southern and, in time, American food. Many of these foods with roots in African American culture came to be known as soul food. History professor and author Frederick Opie says the name was created during the Black Power movement of the mid to late 1960s. It was a way to identify food that showed the history of African Americans. He adds that soul food is also food that African Americans began to create a long time ago to eat with dignity as enslaved people in the diaspora. I'm Jill Robbins.
A Tanzanian woman is traveling around Africa demonstrating her soccer ball skills as a way to feed her family. Her name is Hadara Charles Mjeje. Short videos of her in action have received a lot of attention on social media. Last month, one of her videos even caught the attention of United States President Donald Trump. He wrote on the website Twitter, "Amazing." Mjeje started working on her ball movement, or juggling skills, when she was growing up in Tanzania. For many years, she played for a local women's soccer team. Mjeje hits the ball with her feet, head, and upper body, but not her hands. Mjeje is a 29-year-old single mother of two boys. For the past 6 years, she has been using her special juggling skills to help her support them. She asks for $4 for a 2-minute performance. She earns between $45 and $50 a day. She says the money goes toward sending her children to school and buying food for them to eat. So far, Njeje has traveled to Cameroon, Burundi, Gabon, and Malawi to give her performances. At a recent show in Malawi, she told VOA, "There is no magic in this ball. This is my own talent I started developing long ago." In Malawi, her skill got the attention of the country's national women's football officials. They were interested in bringing her into their women's soccer development program. Njeje turned down the offer. Sugzo Ngwera is the head of the Women's Football Committee in central Malawi. She said that if Njeje were ready to use her skills with other players, her organization would explore ways of working with Njeje. Njeje's skills have caught the interest of male soccer players too. Samuel Zeka plays social football in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. He says it is a rare talent for women to juggle the ball as well as she does. "I would be very grateful if she would teach me such skills," Zeka added. Njeje said she wished the American president could have done more to help her than write a supportive message on Twitter. She said she wished Trump had offered to help feed her family. Along with her children, she also has her aging parents to care for. But Trump's reaction on Twitter did lead to extra attention. Shortly after, she received requests for interviews from local and international news agencies, including the BBC and Reuters. She returned to Tanzania in early March after an agent traveled to Malawi to meet her. The agent wanted to share the possibility of signing an advertising contract that could earn her a lot of money in Spain. Njeje said she hopes the new contract marks the beginning of a better life. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome back, everyone. Last week, I answered a question from a reader about the prepositions on and onto. The other part of the question was about two more prepositions, in and into. So today, I will talk about them. Then, I will offer a tip on when to use all four words. First, here is the question again from last week.
I would like to know when I should use in, into, on, or onto. Thanks.
Thank you again for the question. As you may know, a preposition is a word that is used to show direction, position, or time. Like many English prepositions, in and into have more than one meaning. But to compare their uses, we need to focus on two things, position and direction. The first thing to know is that in is about position and into is about direction. We use the word in to show the position of something within or inside a larger place or area. In suggests the person or thing is at rest. So, we use verbs that suggest being at rest. Listen to a few examples.
I am sitting in a coffee house writing a story.
The iguana is hiding in the tree.
Oh no, I left my Metro card in the house.
The word into suggests movement toward something. We use it when a person or thing moves from an area outside to the inside. Here are a few examples.
I walked into the coffee house and ordered a latte.
The iguana jumped into the water and swam away.
Oh no, my phone just fell into the sink.
You will probably hear English speakers using the word in when they really mean into. For example, someone might say,
Oh no, my phone just fell in the sink.
Into is more correct, but in speech, in is a lot more common with some motion-related verbs, such as fall and put. And now for the tip. Use the words on and in for position or location. The person or thing is usually at rest, so the verb usually does not suggest movement. Use onto and into for direction. The person or thing is moving toward something. So, the verbs will suggest movement. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
The Blue Hotel, Part 3.
At once, Johnny pushed forward.
Why did you say I cheated? Why did you say I cheated? I don't cheat, and I won't let any man say I do.
The Swede said,
I saw you! I saw you!
Well,
cried Johnny,
I'll fight any man who says I cheat.
No, you won't,
said the cowboy.
Not here.
Johnny spoke to the Swede again.
Did you say I cheated?
The Swede showed his teeth.
Yes.
Then,
said Johnny,
we must fight.
Yes, fight!
Roared the Swede. He was like a mad devil.
Yes, fight! I'll show you what kind of a man I am. I'll show you who you want to fight. Maybe you think I can't fight. Maybe you think I can't. I'll show you, you criminal. Yes, you cheated. You cheated. You cheated.
Well, let's start then, fella,
said Johnny coolly. The cowboy turned in despair to Scully.
What are you going to do now?
A change had come over the old man. He now seemed all eagerness. His eyes glowed.
We'll let them fight,
he answered bravely.
I can't watch this any longer. I've endured this cursed Swede till I'm sick. We'll let them fight.
The men prepared to go out. The Easterner was so nervous that he had great difficulty putting on his new leather coat. As the cowboy pulled his fur cap down over his ears, his hands trembled. In fact, Johnny and old Scully were the only ones who displayed no emotion. No words were spoken during these proceedings. Scully threw open the door. Instantly, a wild wind caused the flame of the lamp to struggle for its life. The men lowered their heads and pushed out into the cold. No snow was falling, but great clouds of it, swept up from the ground by the fierce winds, were streaming all around. The covered land was a deep blue, and there was no other color except one light shining from the low, black railroad station. It looked like a tiny jewel. The Swede was calling out something. Scully went to him, put a hand on his shoulder, and indicated an ear.
What did you say?
I said,
screamed the Swede again.
I won't have a chance against this crowd. I know you'll all jump on me.
No, no, man,
called Scully. But the wind tore the words from his lips and scattered them far. The Swede shouted a curse, but the storm also seized the remainder of the sentence. The men turned their backs upon the wind and walked to the shelter side of the hotel. Here, a V-shaped piece of icy grass had not been covered by the snow. When they reached the spot, it was heard that the Swede was still screaming.
Oh, I know what kind of a thing this is. I know you'll jump on me. I can't beat you all.
Scully turned on him angrily.
You won't have to beat all of us. You'll have to beat my son, Johnny. And the man that troubles you during that time will have to deal with me.
The arrangements were quickly made. The two men faced each other, obeying the short commands of Scully. The Easterner was already cold, and he was jumping up and down. The cowboys stood rock-like. The fighters had not removed any clothing. Their hands were ready, and they eyed each other in a calm way that had the elements of fierce cruelty in it.
Now,
said Scully. The two leaped forward and struck together like oxen. There was heard the dull sound of blows and of a curse pressed out between the tight teeth of one. As for the watchers, the Easterners held in breath burst from him in relief, pure relief after the anxious waiting. The cowboy leaped into the air with a scream. Scully stood unmoving, as if in complete surprise and fear at the fierceness of the fight which he himself had permitted and arranged. For a time, the fight in the darkness was such a scene of flying arms that it showed no more detail than a moving wheel. Sometimes a face would shine out, frightful and marked with pink spots. A moment later, the men would be only shadows. Suddenly, the cowboy was caught by warlike desires, and he leaped forward with the speed of a wild horse.
Hit him, Johnny! Hit him! Kill him! Kill him!
Keep still,
said Scully, icily. Then there was a sudden loud sound, dull, incomplete, cut short. Johnny's body fell away from the Swede with sickening heaviness to the grass. The cowboy hardly had time to prevent the mad Swede from throwing himself upon the fallen body. Scully was at his son's side.
Johnny, Johnny, my boy.
His voice had a quality of sad tenderness.
Johnny, can you fight some more?
He looked anxiously down into the bloody, beaten face of his son. There was a moment of silence. And then Johnny answered in his ordinary voice.
Yes.
Helped by his father, he struggled to his feet.
Wait a minute now till you get your breath,
said the old man. A few steps away, the cowboy was telling the Swede.
No, you don't. Wait a second.
The Easterner was pulling at Scully's arm.
Oh, this is enough,
he begged.
This is enough. Let it go as it is. This is enough.
Bill,
said Scully.
Get out of the way.
The cowboy stepped aside.
Now.
The fighters advanced toward each other. Then the Swede aimed a lightning blow that carried with it his entire weight. Johnny, though faint from weakness, luckily stepped aside, and the unbalanced Swede fell to the ground. The cowboy, Scully, and the Easterner cheered. But before its finish, the Swede was up and attacking his enemy madly. There were more wildly moving arms, and Johnny's body again fell away like a stone. The Swede quickly struggled to a little tree and leaned upon it, breathing hard while his fierce and flame-lit eyes wandered from face to face as the men bent over Johnny.
"Can you still fight, Johnny?"
asked Scully in a voice of despair. After a moment, the son answered.
"No, I can't fight anymore."
Then, from shame and bodily ill, he began to weep, the tears pouring down through the blood on his face.
"He was too heavy for me."
Scully straightened and spoke to the waiting figure.
"Stranger,"
he said calmly,
"we're finished."
Then his voice changed into that deep and quiet tone, which is the tone of the most simple and deadly announcements.
"Johnny is beaten."
Without replying, the winner moved away to the door of the hotel. The others raised Johnny from the ground, and as soon as he was on his feet, he refused all attempts at help. When the group came around the corner, they were almost blinded by the blowing snow. It burned their faces like fire. The cowboy carried Johnny through the piles of snow to the door. Inside, they were greeted by a warm stove and women who took Johnny to the kitchen. The three others sat around the heat, and the sad quiet was broken only by the sounds overhead when the Swede moved about in his room. Soon they heard him on the stairs. He threw the door open and walked straight to the middle of the room. No one looked at him.
"Well,"
he said loudly to Scully,
"I suppose you'll tell me now how much I owe you."
The old man, with a dull expression, remained calm.
"You don't owe me anything."
"Mr. Scully,"
called the Swede again,
"how much do I owe you?"
He was dressed to go, and he had his bag in his hand.
"You don't owe me anything,"
repeated Scully in the same unmoved way.
"I guess you're right. I guess the truth would be that you would owe me something. That's what I guess."
He turned to the cowboy.
"Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!"
he repeated in the tone the cowboy had used. Then he laughed. But he might have been laughing at the dead. The three men did not move or speak, just stared with glassy eyes at the stove. The Swede opened the door and passed into the storm, giving one last glance at the still group.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.